tonight on Arena. The latest news live from the Croisette at this year's Cannes Film Festival, and new albums from Paul Weller, Ro Urel and Keeleen Rose up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 77th Cannes Film Festival reaches its climax on Saturday when all eyes will be on the Croisette as the winners of the prestigious Palme d'Or are announced. Hollywood guests such as Meryl Streep, Jane Fonda, Greta Gerwig have been in town, with Gerwig at the helm of the festival jury and a healthy splice of Irish talent with Nicolas Cage in the film The Surfer, directed by Lorcan Finnegan. Irish co-productions The Apprentice, Kinds of Kindness, September Says, On Becoming a Guinea Fowl, representing some of our biggest production houses, Element and Tailored Films, are also present. Film critic and writer Tara Brady joins me on the line live from Cannes. You were saying that we are seeing a film jury with more women represented than usual, Tara.
Oh, very much so. And I think it's very significant and obviously meant to be emblematic that they've parachuted Greta Gerwig in to be the president of the jury. We also have Lily Gladstone, Ava Green, and Nadine Labaki, and then we have J.A. Bayona, the Spanish director, the very kind of charismatic Italian actor Pian Francisco Favino, and Carita Hirokazu and Omar Sy and Urbo Salan, a Turkish screenwriter. So it's a very good, diverse kind of mix. And of course, everyone's sitting around going, well, I think Greta will pick this. And, I think Carita will pick that. You know, my guess is we'll probably all get it wrong in the end. And because it's Cannes and everybody watches four or five films a day, it's very fast moving. So overnight, yeah, Suddenly we have a new favourite in the race. As of an hour ago, we've had the premiere of Mohammed Rasoulov's Seed of the Sacred Fig, which received a 12-minute standing ovation. So now people are saying that's the favourite. Obviously, it's quite significant that he's here because it's an Iranian film and included our images of women not wearing their hijab, and he's been sentenced under indecency laws. He has fled to Europe in order to escape a horse-whipping sentence. So, but we'll see if the 12-minute ovation was for him or for the movie. I will, as soon as I finish talking to you, because I'll be heading to that next.
Heading to that at that point. So that may become the new favourite, because up until that, we had certainly a new favourite in All We Imagine Is Light. It came to the fore, was last evening?
Yes, indeed. And ordinarily, Sean, like when we're at the kind of big festivals like Cannes and Venice, that very often they're kind of front heavy or top loaded, as they say. The kind of big hitters happen in the first, you know, 3-4 nights. And that hasn't been the case with this Cannes at all. It's been actually quite slow moving to get started. And it really wasn't until Emilia Perez, the big Mexican musical premiere, that everybody started getting really excited. But yeah, All We Imagine Is Life is an absolutely lovely film. I guarantee you it'll be your favourite film of the festival. That would be my bet. It's about these three nurses. One of them is Anu, and she's kind of the sensible but very kindly stern nurse. She'll give you a scolding for not taking your pills, but she'll also do absolutely everything to help you. And she is sharing her apartment with a kind of young nurse who's kind of been a bit mischievous and is stepping out with a Muslim boyfriend that she's not supposed to have. And then the third person is this canteen worker in the hospital, and she's about to lose her home because her husband has died. And the piece of paper that shows that her home belonged to her, she can't find it among his effects. And it comes from Payal Kapadia, who's a documentary maker. She actually won a prize for a documentary here 2 years ago. There's a real kind of sense of place and of Mumbai and of what it's like for these women. And there's a lot of voices in the film that you hear talking about the fact that in India and in Mumbai, people don't really expect to be in one place for all of their lives. So it has a lot to say about diaspora. And it also has a lot of kind of sadness around Anu, because there's a doctor who's very interested in her and who writes her a poem and who cooks her sweets at home. But she has a husband who's in Germany. So it's that idea of people who... Right. are in relationships and things, but are very, very far apart because of economic conditions.
Well, certainly you've put it to the top of my list of must sees in the coming weeks and months. You mentioned Emilia Perez, and of course that's a big comeback, I suppose, for Jacques Audiard coming back to Cannes. But there are three other firm favourites in the midst of all of this as well. Anora, directed by Sean Baker. The screwball comedy is back in fashion.
It really is. And, you know, Sean Baker, who did, you know, Red Rocket, and who loves these kind of and Tangerine, and he loves these kind of sleazy worlds that are kind of low lives and, you know, kind of people who are like do sex work on the side or people who make porn films and this. But they're always really kind of, you know, Cinderella stories, but with a little bittersweet twist. Like they always fit. They're always like kind of great stories. And this is the big, huge crowd pleaser of the festival. This is the one that everybody just laughed for 2 hours. Solid at. It has that kind of real "it happened one night" feel about it, because, you know, even though it's set in this world of like lap dancing and low life mobsters, it's an incredibly like just fast kind of romp, and everybody is speaking and swearing, of course, at the speed of something like His Girl Friday. So it has this incredible central performance from Mikey Madison, who's really only done like bit parts before in things like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino film. And she's working in a laptop joint when Ivan, this kind of clueless young Russian, comes into the club. They party. They end up doing this impromptu Vegas wedding. And then the oligarch, who is Ivan's father, and even more scary, the oligarch's wife, hear about this, and they dispense these three kind of bumbling Armenian henchmen to go and make sure that the annulment is sorted before their private plane lands from Russia into New York airport. And absolutely everything goes wrong. No, and it has a really lovely performance as well from, if you remember, Compartment Number 6 is Yura Borisov, who was like the Gopnik in that film. And he plays a kind of version of that again,
right,
who's like this, you know, looks like this terrifying skinhead, but really has a heart of gold.
Let's move on to another comedy that's in there as well. A renaissance for Demi Moore this time, in a piece in a film called The Substance. This is a very interesting premise. Let's have a listen to Demi Moore as Elizabeth Sparkle, as she inserts a USB stick labelled with the title of the film, The Substance, into her TV. She sits back as a mysterious voice speaks to her.
Have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Younger, more beautiful, more perfect. One single injection unlocks your DNA, starting a new cellular division that will release another version of yourself. This is The Substance.
You know, if you hear it out of context, it sounds serious, but clearly it's a comedy that's at play there. And Elizabeth, or Demi Moore rather, is Elizabeth Sparkle, in this idea of, have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? There's something interesting about that. But let us go to the Irish material, and in particular Lorcan Finnegan's film starring Nicolas Cage. This is written by Thomas Martin, set on a muscle beach in Australia, not necessarily about surfing. What is it about?
It's, I guess, the thing that would have the most in common with is that kind of classic exploitation film from like the 70s and 80s, where somebody goes to the outback, somebody civilized goes to the outback and is intimidated by all these kind of muscular, brutish locals. So it's a very, you'd be thinking about films like Wake and Fright, or more recently like Kitty Green revived that kind of form with Grand Hotel and did a kind of female version of it. So it's similar to that, but it puts a kind of spin on it, because it's not this kind of forbidding outback. It's this kind of really beautiful, like luscious beach with azure skies and surfers. And Nicolas Cage, who grew up around this beach, they have to do a little bit of jiggery pokery and explanation as to how he grew up on an Australian beach. But that's fine. It fits with the kind of the Cage persona very well. And he brings his teenage son to the beach, and the locals go, don't live here, can't surf here. They're really intimidating. It turns out the beach is run by this weird, toxic male surfing cult who believe you have to suffer in order to surf. And for some reason, Nicolas Cage will not be told. He hangs around there. Everything goes wrong for him. He hasn't got any water. He loses his, he can't charge his phone. Suddenly his car disappears, and we're starting to wonder, wait, is this all happening in his mind? So it's a really kind of fun Very old school kind of paranoid thriller.
Right, let's have a listen to Nicolas Cage as the surfer of the title. He wants his surfboard back in this scene. It's hanging above the door frame of the sanctuary. So you'll all hear, here in this clip, Julian McMahon as Scally, Justin Rozniak as the cop, are kind of this group of surfers who have stalked their claim over this beach from childhood. There is some adult language in this clip.
I told you to wait up in the car park.
I want my surfboard.
Okay. I'm sure it's just a mix-up. Is it one of these?
Dude, that's my board, and I want it back.
Listen, mate, I think you've been out in the sun too long.
They took it from me last night. They threatened me with a broken bottle.
Why don't you take a drink of water?
I don't want anything from you. I want my board.
So you're saying they took this from you last night?
Was I not clear?
Well, it's just the problem is, and I can tell you myself, that old board's been up there for as long as I can remember. How long?
I reckon we put it up there maybe 7 summers back now. She's a beaut, isn't she? I guess it's like a talisman for us.
What the fuck is this?
Sir, it is in your best interest to get back up to the car park and wait for me by your vehicle.
There we go. Yes, I don't think I'd mess with those surfers either. That is a clip from The Surfer featuring Nicolas Cage, directed by Lorcan Finnegan, as I said. Staying with an Irish interest, the Tailored Films co-production, this is The Apprentice, starring Sebastian Stan as a young Donald Trump. Bit of controversy around this, is there, Tara?
There really is. It's the fun little film. It's a little bit cartoonish, but that may be a function of the fact that it's about these kind of larger than life characters, shall we say. It does include, despite the fact that it's mostly played for comedy, very much in the mode of Succession. It does include a very controversial rape scene, and I think that a lot of people, as they kind of left the cinema, We're thinking, well, that's going to be the last time we see that version of it. And we were kind of wondering immediately, like, oh, will Donald Trump be suing? And of course, he will be suing. And there was a very extensive statement made by one of the legal representatives for his presidential campaign, almost within hours of the film being premiered. It's about Roy Cohen, who, if you remember, was the kind of big closeted scourge of communists during the homosexuals during the Joseph McCarthy witch hunts, and his mentorship of Trump during the 1980s. So it's quite an interesting film, and it features Sebastian Stan as Trump, who's very, very good and gets all the mannerisms right, and Jeremy Strong from Succession, which kind of doubles down a little bit on the Succession feel of the film.
Big buzzy world premiere at the festival last week from Francis Ford Coppola's huge project, passion project, Megalopolis. Didn't win the hearts and minds right across the board.
Do you know, I'm just after coming from his old chum, because there's a bit of a theme of the kind of new Hollywood guys being over this year. So Paul Schrader was over with O Canada, which was a very good film as well this week. But I've just come from a like 90 minutes like in conversation with George Lucas. And George Lucas was talking about the fact, because obviously they go way back, you know, whenever he makes a film, or Steven Spielberg makes a film, or Francis Ford Coppola makes a film, they all, you know, go over to each other's houses and go, well, you know, give each other notes. And he was like going, you know, so you know, Francis gets us over to like give notes on this. And, you know, we kept telling him, well, you know, nobody's going to get this story. It's like, but he never listens to us. And it's very clear he doesn't listen to them. Right. I wouldn't say it's absolute rubbish, but it, you know, there's kind of very interesting images in it, but by golly, it's a bit of a dog's dinner. It's like this Roman Empire themed science fiction starring Adam Driver as Caesar, who's like this visionary architect who wants to make the city a better place. He's, you know, opposed by people like Giancarlo Esposito's mayor, Shia LaBeouf's kind of demagogue, and then Aubrey Plaza's Golding celebrity journalist. There are all these kind of competing plot lines. There's this love story, which doesn't really work at all. And like Coppola said, that the film is a tribute to his late wife, Elaine, who actually died earlier this year. It is a mess, but nonetheless, it is absolutely the hottest ticket on the Croisette.
There you go.
They're having to show it again, I think, twice tomorrow because the demand for tickets is so high. And when I went to see it the other day, there was a very quarrelsome queue, I can tell you.
Now, there you go. I hope you weren't one of the quarrelers. I wouldn't be right if I didn't ask you about fashion on the red carpet, given that that is our yearly question around Cannes.
well, we love a good frock. And of course, everybody is talking about Cate Blanchett's Jean-Paul Gaultier gown, which was designed by the Colombian designer Haider Ackermann. So there's a huge debate about this dress, whether or not it was a tribute to the Palestinian flag or whether the red is in fact a trick of light from the red carpet. And it's a sort of optical illusion. I think we know Cate Blanchett is a very reliable red carpet sort of person. We also know that she has made speeches about Gaza before, and she signed an artist petition to Joe Biden calling for ceasefire only in recent months. I think Cate Blanchett knows her frocks very well, and yeah. I don't think she would have worn the frock by accident. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree with you on that one. I've left Kinds of Kindness to last, which is Yorgos Lanthimos and Element Pictures involved in this. I got to see a screening of this. I'm not allowed to say too much about it at any rate, but three different stories, but all played by the same cast in the different stories.
So it's very like one of those old horror anthologies that you used to get, like from Hammer Horrors or Amicus Horrors in the 70s from Britain. It's like something like that. I think unfortunately the first story works really well. It feels like a classic Lanthimos story. The second one and the third one didn't work for me at all. And they're very good actors in them, but I think the kind of the Lanthimos magic is always that. It's a weird world, but the rules of it are very consistent and disciplined. And the second one and third one have characters kind of doing things randomly that aren't consistent and just kind of doing weird things for the sake of weird things. And I think the general consensus is that the third one is a bit of a disaster. The second one is less of a disaster. But only the first one works,
really,
unfortunately.
Works. Okay, well, let's finish up and let you get off to your screening. Thanks for teeing us up as to what is happening there. Enjoy the rest of the festival. We see you when you get back, Tara Brady there. And we'll finish with a clip from Kinds of Kindness. Emma Stone's character Rita here propositions the group of friends, four of them, two husbands, two wives, to go upstairs for some fun. Her co-stars Margaret Qualley, who plays Vivian, Jesse Plemons, who plays Robert, and Mamadou Athi as Will, are not quite as keen as she is.
Can I have a cigarette?
Sure. I didn't know you smoked, Liz.
I don't. I've never smoked. Can you believe that? I've never even tried. It just really felt like a cigarette. Should we all go upstairs to the bedroom?
I think it's best we don't go up to the bedroom tonight.
What we're gonna find the table? Come on, Daniel. That would be weird.
We'd better be getting home soon. Liz, look, you must be tired, and I have to be up early. But everything was wonderful tonight, though.
I think you're right. I think we should leave it for some other time. Maybe next time.
I'll clean up the plates.
Artist Hilary Herron is the focus of a new exhibition at the Irish Museum of Modern Art, the latest in its Modern Masters series, curated by Sean Cassan. Born in Dublin in 1923, Hilary Herron studied at NCAD, went on to become a pioneering modernist sculptor. She represented Ireland at the 1956 Venice Biennale alongside painter Louis Le Broquet, an honour which brought her to an international audience, particularly in the US. She was only 54 when she died, and her profile as an artist has since faded somewhat from view. Hilary Herron, a retrospective, is the first major retrospective of her art since 1964. Jess Fahey has been to Emma to see the show, and she's with me in studio right now. As usual, we will tweet some images as we go along here. We get to see the sculptures here, because so often in the case of artists like this, Jess, you're looking at pictures or photos of the sculptures themselves. It's even more important with sculptures that you actually get to see them, I suppose, because of the 3D nature. But before we get into that, who was she? Who was Henry Heron?
So she was from a Presbyterian family from the north of Ireland and initially grew up in Coleraine and then moved down to New Ross in Wexford. And as you already mentioned, went to NCAD. And the sort of intriguing thing about her is that she doesn't sort of fit the mold of expectations of any aspect of her background or her gender or the time period that she's from. And she seems to just have this, you know, essentially incredible talent, but also this desire to create and sculpt and make these really fascinating, interesting pieces. And this propels her certainly for about, you know, 20, 30 years of her career.
I'm going to tweet an image of Crazy Jane 3, which not only is of the piece of sculpture itself, but also of the artist. Henry Heron is sitting down at the bottom with a cigarette in her hand. The Crazy Jane 3, Yeatsian scholars will recognise the Crazy Jane reference there.
Yeah, so it is quite humorous. And again, that's very appropriate for the type of subject she often chose. There's a real tongue-in-cheek kind of element to her work. But the Yeats character of an old woman is arguing with a bishop over having the necessity of living a life of sin, otherwise you've nothing to atone for. So this, again, created by an Irish woman in the 1950s, you're sort of thinking that there might be a little dig that she's trying to get in there in relation to how women are supposed to live and exist in Irish society. And it's a wild sculpture too. You know, there's no denying that as soon as you look at it, it's bizarre, almost sort of surrealist and strange.
What is the material there? Is it bronze?
It's welded steel.
Welded steel.
So she worked predominantly in steel, which again was such an unusual thing. She's the first Irish artist to exhibit welded steel works. And of course, there was this assumption that as a woman artist, she shouldn't be doing that. But I always kind of put it into connection with World War II and the women working in factories and welding, and it was perfectly fine then, you know, and she's sort of that generation.
Yes, and there is a wonderful quote that you have from, is it Reg Butler? Give us that quote about sculptors.
So the gist of it is essentially that women shouldn't be sculptors. Now, I think he's sort of talking about the environment, and he said, you can either be a good sculptor or a good woman, but you can't be both.
It was impossible for a woman to be a sculptor. If she was a good sculptor, she wasn't a good woman. Quite an extraordinary statement, really, isn't it?
Exactly.
And I suppose it feeds into the question as to why we don't know more about Henry Heron.
It is a big open-ended question. And actually, there was a great symposium yesterday in Trinity. And, you know, a lot of the people like Billy Shortall and others have been doing great research on her over the years. We're putting together sort of whatever they could find in relation to answering that. She does seem to have had ill health later. You know, so as you said, she died very young. So maybe that kind of stopped her creating, and that kind of got her in a way out of public notice. There's not many works by her in public collections because there wasn't a tendency to buy works by women, you know, so there's probably a gendered element to it as well, but it's not an easy answered thing. And there's an element of, you know, some people have suggested as well, she didn't protect her own reputation or curate her own archive or things like that, that people like Jack B. Yeats did, you know, so maybe the artist needs to do more to be remembered.
And there is another aspect to her work, which is she seems to have had this kind of almost celebrity status in terms of the press, as in the printed press. And it's interesting what they've done to kind of show us that within this exhibition. Very clever.
It's one of my favourite things, actually, about, you know, this is, it's very well organised because they do thematically room by room. So you get to see just how versatile she was in terms of material, even within the same subject or type of image. But then in between that, they have sort of blown up almost like plaster sort of wallpaper and different press cuttings that relate to her, including an ad for Pond's Cream. And Pond's Cold Cream, like my grandmother did swear by it too, and she was born the same year.
Well, she also told me, you told me something I didn't know before, which is Lady Lavery also was an advertiser on Pond's Cream.
And actually in her version, it was a painted image by John Lavery of her. And again, saying, you know, this incredible beauty uses Pond's Cold Cream. But in the case of Hilary Herons, it's sort of introducing her almost like this young starlet. It talks about her, you know, beautiful hair, her deep green eyes. And this is for an ad. So in a way, it kind of makes sense. But the press generally talked about her like that, too. And her appearance was paramount and much more important. certainly in photographs, than any for work. You know, so this is something that male artists never had to deal with. I mean, whether they were good looking or not, never occurred to anyone.
Yeah, and nobody asked them to, you know, dress up while they were hacking their, or hauling their loads of steel to be welded together around with them.
Exactly, to wear a pretty dress and high heels while welding, not practical. Yeah.
No, not at all. Let's tweet another image, and this is called Bird Barking at RTE Arena, by the way, if you want to see these images again. And again, ironically, she is at the side of this.
Yeah.
She's at the side of this particular image as well. The exhibition has been arranged thematically, as you said, by room. Mm. And this is in a room which has flight as a theme. But bird barking, obviously a hybrid form. Is hybridity important here?
It is. And it wouldn't be that unusual for post-war artists that tended to lean towards the animalistic kind of distortions and things as a way of kind of dealing with the, you know, the tragedies of war and such.
Yeah.
I think in her case, though, there's much more humour to it than necessarily that kind of darker side. It's almost like a kind of mini aeroplane, you know, in the sort of construction of it, or more fish-like. It's certainly humorous. It has a kind of uncanny, sense to it. And that idea of what should be a melodious bird call being represented as barking. There's another work by her there of Anna Livia, so the Liffey personified, that's holding again a kind of cawing seagull. And it does make you remember that, you know, the seagull is the more predominant bird often in Dublin, and it is loud and squawky. And we might have to, you know, think about that as a kind of urban animal in a way.
I'll tweet the third image that we have here, which is Torso 3. And this this is in a room that has the male form as its theme. This is, a piece that speaks more directly to the post-war period and the horrors of World War II.
It does. I should say first that it's really quite unusual for a woman, particularly an Irish woman in this era, to deal with the male form, particularly the nude male form, and particularly in sculpture. In this instance, in the Torso 3, it's very highly stylized and abstracted, and it sort of looks like a stretched sack with these kind of pointy limbs, almost kind of looking demonic, because the torso could be mistaken sort of for a face in a way. But if we read it as a torso, as she sort of instructs with the title, the legs seem kneeling, the arms seem up in air, almost in a sort of surrender or pleading, and then we start thinking about, you know, man's inhumanity to man. And other artists like Bacon and others use these kind of carcass-like forms as well in a similar kind of response.
Yeah, the minute you put it into that post-war context, I mean, I certainly see that torso in a very dark way. There's no humour involved in that.
Mm.
Where does she sit? And I know you have drawn this, comparison and likeness with Minnie Jellett and the attitude of the postmoderns, the modernists rather, in Ireland.
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating stories about Irish art is that our avant-garde movements, our modernists, were predominantly women. And not only were they working for themselves, but they built an environment that supported other modernists when a lot of the institutions were very, you know, conservative and conventional, wanted traditional proper art as they saw it. So Minnie Jellett was the first chair of the Irish Exhibition of Living Art, which had its first exhibition in 1943. Hilary Heron exhibited at that when she was still a student, and then most years of her career up to about 66, and she was also on the board. So she's very much part of that world and of that link between ideas they had in relation to the abstract forms in Celtic art, which could be easily matched with the modernist movement, which Minnie Jellett, you know, talked about extensively and made sense in a new Ireland as a new Irish art sort of pre-colonial.
And speaks, I suppose, to the success of Norma McGuinness and others who went to the Biennale. She was Heron became hugely important internationally. A lot of collectors collected her work then.
Well, it's like the Olympics of art, the Biennale. So to be there is a really important thing. Yeah. And she was a little overshadowed by Labrocki at it, but I still think it was a
and a lot of the work that is there in MF for this exhibition is from private collections. So
course,
you very seldom get a chance to see it. Worth seeing, Jess. 100%.
Yeah, 100%. Fantastic.
100% worth seeing, says Jess Fahey of Hilary Heron, a retrospective, which is at the Irish Museum of Modern Art. It is there through until the 20th of October. Full details on imma.ie. And so time for our weekly album reviews. Owen Glacken and Sinead Ní Bhorga are with me, and they have been listening to three albums, one from old style counsellor himself, Paul Weller. 66 is the title of the album that marks this age milestone in his life. It has the advancing age. Is 66 advanced age? Put a jam on his, oh dear, near perfect songwriting. That is the question for our reviewers this evening. Roy Urell, known as the vocalist and guitarist of Irish indie rock band De Laurentiis, has gone it alone with Commencer, and it sees Urell pair it all back. Very reflective, very romantic type of sound here. And Manchester singer-songwriter Kaylin Rose, her new album is called Constellation. Very dreamy folk songs. But let's get back to where we started with Mr. Paul Weller, marking his 66th birthday with an album called 66. And here's a track called I Woke Up. I'm trying to find I Woke Up from Paul Weller from his new album 66. And I was saying, Sinead Ní Bhorga and Eoghan Glacken, as I was listening to that, only Paul Weller could get away with kind of 12-year-old guitar playing at the beginning of a song like that. But he's kind of quite contemplative and meditative mood in that song, Sinead.
He has. He's changed a little bit, I guess. You know, I guess what a lot of albums have been released at the moment, it came out about around the time of the lockdown. And, you know, and he's been quite contemplative, I guess, at the time. And I guess that the mood about this album is quite different. I mean, here you have a guy who's penned some of the catchiest songs ever written, with the likes of Going Underground, In the City, Start, That's Entertainment, through to Shout to the Top of the Soil Council. But with this, there's something quite, it's classical and old school. There's actually quite a wealth of choral harmonies. You've got harp in there, strings, you've got a flute solo, so smouldering sax, you've got those sun-dappled ballads, you know, a la the 50s and 60s. And then you've got, you know, a melancholic kind of closing one, Burnout, that reminds me a lot of Black Star from David Bowie. And then you've got nine of the songs have got collaborative efforts. You know, he's invited a lot of people to collaborate, to write lyrics. And then along with Bowie, you have touches of Bacharach, and you've got Blur even with that chamber pop sound. And then amongst the softly sung ballads, you have a French waltz and surprisingly some disco. Yeah. He meanders quite a lot.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking on when listening to this album. If you think of True Meanings, the album from 2018, which kind of was very much folk rock and just the acoustic guitar type of feel to it. This has a bit of that there, but it has everything else, including the kitchen sink in there too.
Sure. I mean, when that opens up, Ship of Fools, the first track, and you've got that lovely melodic folky guitar playing, and you think, okay, this is 2018 again, but it moves off in some great directions. Again, there's flourishes of disco in there from the get go on Flying Fish track two,
and he manages to do that without it being cheesy.
That's exactly it. And see, that what I find when I was putting my notes together, it's that to try and pinpoint references in other artists in Paul Weller's work is kind of redundant, because his back catalogue is so diverse, so rich, that anything you can point at and go, oh, that reminds me of disco, or that reminds me of Elvis Costello, or that reminds me, you go, well, it also reminds me of Paul Weller back in 92, or, you know, the Style Council or whatever. He's done so much himself already that you don't need to reference anybody else. You can just look at his own back catalogue to find his own inspirations on this record.
And if the track that we started out with, I Woke Up, had the very simple kind of almost childish guitar, very different sound in Soul Wandering. Soul Wandering from Paul Weller there, and his new album 66. And there, that's a perfect example of it, Sinead. You know, totally different style of song from the first one we heard.
Exactly.
And that kind of is true across all 12 of them. Does it, however, all sit together as an album? Were you happy at the end of it? Will Paul Weller fans be happy at the end of it?
Paul Weller fans will be definitely impressed by. I mean, the last couple of albums went straight to number one. It's guaranteed to do really well. It does meander, but I guess that's true to his nature of always wanting to push ahead. I think he gets a bit antsy when it comes to people who don't want to push and don't have the same kind of, I guess, relentless work rate that he has. And that is like a mid-tempo rocker that we would kind of come to expect, and co-written with Bobby Gillespie. And those gorgeous gospel-style vocals in that one from Louise Clare Marshall and Samudu Jayatelek, who performed with the choir London Voices. It is a little bit all over the place. When I first listened to it, I wasn't too sure, but with each listen, I got more into the vibe and the collaborations that gave breathe a new life into the songs, I guess, that he would have written beforehand.
All right. And what about the voice? Is the voice holding up for you, Owen?
The voice for me is what always brings it all together with Weller. You know, that strong as oak voice that could carry a tank over Mount Everest. It's relentless. It's gorgeous. It's soothing. It's, you can hear his age, but it nothing has lost from it. It's his storytelling is still there. I mean, as he sings in that song just now, he is still searching, and as you just touched on there, he's always trying to move forward and bring in new influences and draw on his past. And as I said earlier on, everything that he's done, there's tastes of it everywhere. You know, his entire sonic palette is drawn on somewhere in this record. If you listen close enough, you'll hear it.
Stars from you then, Owen.
It's a strong four for me.
Strong four, Sinead.
Going to give it a four as well.
All right, pretty solid from both of you then for Paul Weller, and 66, and not too ruminating in it. He seems to be still happy.
No, 66. That song, that first song we played, you know, you're expecting someone like with his sort of grumpy demeanour to look at ageing with a more bitter sort of twist.
But no.
But it's a beautiful song about a man waking up in his 60s and thinking, oh, things are getting a little bit different. That's it's nice.
All right. Let us move on then to Ro Urell, known, as I say, to many of us as the vocalist and guitarist with the Irish indie rock band De Laurentiis. He's described himself this album Commencer as a coming-of-age record recorded at the famous Attica Audio Recording Studio in County Donegal. It coincided with Urell starting a family during a global pandemic. I mean, so much of what we, when we talk about any album, any piece of art, it's somehow the pandemic, it marked a change of some kind. I guess the starting of a family and new life like that coming into his world has made him a different musician.
Certainly, he describes it as a coming of age record, and that's, it feels that way. It's about a person. He's very much in love. There is an incredible sense of romance in these songs, but the songs feel like it's someone coming to accept themselves, their place in the world, accepting love from somebody else, accepting their ability to love somebody else. It's all in there. At times, it can get a little bit too, you know, maybe veering on schmaltzy in some of the lyrics, but I think it's all, even the overly romantic things, not overly romantic, but the romantic sentiments are couched in a sort of a yearning and this sense of you know, coming of age, as he says.
And the opening track tells us all to dare to do something that we should do. We all should dare to dream, but can we dream aloud? That is what Ro Urell wants us to do in this opening track. There's the advice for you from Ro Urell on the opening track of his album Commencer. What's extraordinary to my ears about that, Sinead Nivorda, is yes, he is daring us all to dream aloud, but he's managing to do it in a way that doesn't go cheesy, too cheesy anyway.
No, it's he's this ability to create this really lovely, magical soundscape of synth keys and vocals. And for someone who has penned such incredibly catchy indie anthems, you know, with De Laurentiis, who started back in 2005 and went on to get like number seven with the first album and do really, really well, and with a whole slew of award nominations and wins, he creates something very, very different. And he found that, you know, I guess he embraces different topics like, I guess, you know, he went through the lockdown and there's a lot of poverty in the world with war. He delves into those kind of themes. And whilst he would be able to exercise those you know, demons with De Laurentiis, he found himself really struggling to find his own feet and to find his own voice with this. So he just basically found himself having to challenge himself, experiment, keeping an open heart and mind. And he has created this really beautiful folksy soundscape.
Yeah.
It's really, really nice.
Yeah, and you were telling us the Row Your L that we're hearing there is much more laid back and relaxed than your first ever gig, Owen Glacken. Your first big gig.
My first, as I say, proper, you know, quotation marks, proper gig was De Laurentiis in a venue that's now long gone on Abbey Street called The Music Room, it was called, as I remember. And it was a school night. How I was allowed to be there, I'm not sure, but it was a school night. And on the encore, Row smashed what was...
Well, it was either him or one of the other...
It could have been him or Kieran looking back, but it was
Somebody smashed a guitar.
One of them smashed a cheap Samick electric guitar off the ground, and it was the most incredible thing I'd ever witnessed in my life at that point. And my friend Barry still has the body of that guitar at home.
There you go. Does this album work for you and stars for Row Your L, Owen?
It certainly does work for me. Again, there are moments where some of the lyrics... I mean, he sings lines like, you know, put your hand on my chest and you'll see what you mean to me. And a line like that could come across as overly trite, but it is sincere. His vocal delivery is always great, and it's a strong four for me again.
Yeah, and but there are other songs in Citadel, for example, where he talks about from the violent classroom to the country lane. So there are little hints of darkness.
Oh, there is
in there too.
He has a great line about being sick of eating takeaways. You know, there are these little splashes of interesting biting lyrics in there as well. You know,
and Sinead, overall from you.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely see who he counts as his influences there with the likes of Joni Mitchell, the band, Bob Dylan, Villagers. You know, he's got a lovely emotional writer and arranger as well. And his approach, as opposed to focus on a particular style of theme, he feels the music until he arrives at a finished piece. So it was a really lovely kind of sway between fantasy and reality, and it touches of Fleet Foxes and Bon Iver as well. So yeah, quite a lot hooky, not in the obvious indie rock kind of hook,
sure,
but definitely a beautiful grower and quite a magical soundscape.
Yeah, stars?
Four.
So that's two solid fours from both of you. Hmm. Will you be in accord on our third and final album this evening, which comes from the Manchester singer-songwriter Keelan Rose? It's called Constellation. This is both the opening and the title track. There we go. Constellation, the opening track on Keelan Rose, and the title track on Keelan Rose's new album. That track, I think, is... I'm going to go to you first on it, Sinead. That track is a little bit misleading, because that's probably... Well, it's not quite the most upbeat, but it's kind of rocking it a bit in terms of Keelan Rose, isn't it?
I wouldn't have thought rocking it would come to mind in any part of that album. And initially thought, oh, here's a really quiet album, I don't know. But, you know, I absolutely fell in love with it. Like, I loved where she went with it. You know, it's a melting pot of just gorgeous sounds. We've got synth, guitar, sax. We've got, you know, a little piano tinkling. You've got samples, beats, and those gorgeous vocals that she uses as an instrument in itself and creates layers with it. And, you know, she's someone that has an incredible background in education and schooling and went into learning about logic and samples and soundscapes and field recording. So I love what she's done with that traditional folk and the traditional instrument of the piano that she went back to in this third album, but mixing it also with these ambient sounds and field recordings. And then she kind of invited in a collaborative effort as well with artists who were involved with the label that she signed to, if I can find it now in a moment, Godwana Records. So it's just amazing they do. Yeah. Some of just phenomenal jazz drumming is throughout this record.
Yeah, there is a track called
called
Simple, which has a phenomenal rhythm drive in Faster Than Constellation. I was using, of course, the term rocking it up for in a very ironic sense when I talked about it there in terms of that first track. But it does meander a bit. You'd want to be late at night and you'd want to have headphones on for this one, I would argue.
Absolutely. It's an immersive listen if you're willing to go there. But for me, the album is strongest when it gets that balance between the kind of dreamy soundscapes, the layered vocals, these ethereal landscapes. You know, it is gorgeous. But when the song is allowed to poke through a little bit more, that's when it's strongest for me. Again, when it's rooted in actual instruments, that lovely jazz drumming we're talking about, that saxophone that weaves in and out
and
throughout
where
the
does
album.
It go wrong then when it doesn't have that root?
Well,
what happens?
I had a difference between my first and second listen. After my first listen, by the time we got to the last three songs, I was kind of going, oh, it's more of the same. More of these, whoa, it's kind of layered vocal things. And
ethereal stuff.
Yeah, all that. And it was kind of getting a little bit tedious. But on my second listen, my sort of reservations there drifted away and I kind of got lost in a little bit more. There's lovely detail in those sonic landscapes. I shouldn't write them off by kind of just dismissing them.
And
being,
the production is amazing, it is
immaculate production. And again, but where it's strongest for me is when it's rooted in sort of in earthy instruments. There's lovely double bass going on at times, and that kind of cuts through those ethereal layers. You know,
yeah, you're not going to do the.
I'm not
going to
do the ohs anymore. No. But
I
have to be honest. I did find myself thinking at times. Was there conversations in the studio where she would say, I have an idea, and the producer would say, what's that? Would we add a few more ohs? There's always room for more ohs.
Okay, well, actually, I'm not sure whether it's stars or ohs I should be looking for you on this one then. What do you think overall? You're kind of a little bit on the fence after the second listen, are you?
Well, so if we were judging on my first listen, it would probably would have been about 2.5. But I threw myself back into it 2 or 3 more times, and it's now a strong 3 for me.
A strong 3. Oh, I think you're astonished and disgusted, Sinead.
Disgusted. Can you see it on my face? Yeah, I think with each listen, each track Born to My Soul more, I think it's just a real stunning mélange of artistic adventure, musical education, improvisation, hard work, as well as the natural element of nature. She really believes in nature, connecting with nature, trusting that and trusting other musicians and creating that collaborative kind of space to create something magnetic. Okay, one to get lost and get your headphones out. A really strong 4 out of 5 for me.
A strong 4 and a just about 3 for Keelan Rose and Constellation from Owen Glackle and Sinead Niforda there. And before that, Sinead and Owen were speaking about Row Urel, his album Commencer, and Paul Weller's 66. And that is our lot for this Friday evening here on Arena. Paul Shields, Liam Murphy and Barbara Rose Sanwell were the researchers. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Back with you on Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.